In this chapter, we're going to learn about some of what had become necessary business with the beginning of the reign of a new king. Now, I did not say that it was God-approved business. I did not say it was right or righteous or correct, but it had become necessary business. I want you to think with me for just a minute as to why this kind of stuff had become necessary. It was necessary because it was the custom of those times, and God's people, the nation of Israel, was following in the footsteps of their neighbors. They wanted to have a king, and so they felt it necessary to act exactly as others did in regard to kings and reigns and rulers. And so when a king died or when a successor took his throne, there was a lot of the kind of stuff we're going to study about tonight here in chapter 2 that went on. Another reason, obviously, why way back there in 1 Samuel chapter 8, when it says God's people demanded a king, and Samuel was very upset about the fact, and God told him, don't worry about it, it's not you that they've rejected, it's me that they have rejected in the fact that they want to have a king. We looked at a lot of that same kind of goings on last Sunday night, and we said then that there would be a continuation of some of this same kind of information, and indeed chapter 2 does continue the story. Now here's an interesting point that I'm not sure you've picked up on. You may not have realized it unless you've read somebody's commentary, but a lot of commentators tell us that between 1 Kings chapter 1 and 1 Kings chapter 2, you can insert the material that's recorded in 1 Chronicles chapter 23 through chapter 29 as a chronologically proper location for that. And, of course, the first objection that is raised is, in chapter 1, it appears that David is just as good as dead. They've found a young woman to sleep with him and keep him warm. But then in chapter 2, it says that as David's time drew near, and a lot of scholars say that David got better. In fact, in the words of one commentator I read, the flame grew brighter just before it died out. That seems a little cruel to characterize it in that way. But he said David was sick in chapter 1. He got better in the interim and did all of those things that are recorded in those six or seven chapters in 1 Chronicles. And then in chapter 2 of 1 Kings, he died. If you know anything about what goes on there in those chapters in 1 Chronicles, you know that it was the dividing up of the Levites and all of those who served in the tabernacle and arranging them by turns and rounds and designating all different kinds of things. And the logical conclusion was he instigated those changes or instituted those things in preparation for the time when the temple, having been built by Solomon, would be a regular, normal part of daily life in Jerusalem for God's people. I'm not necessarily giving my agreement or endorsement to those things, but I want you to be aware of them. And in fact, in the quest of getting a better understanding of the running story of all of this, I suppose that information may be necessary. But here in chapter 2, again, it is easily divided up into several sections. There are 8 or 9 sections here, and we'll take it a section at a time and study it. And this method of going through the text in this way is reminiscent of the classes that I had under Brother James Turner back in well, never mind, but a long time ago in the School of Religion, Alabama Christian School of Religion, which is now Ambridge University, Brother James would sit down at the desk there in the classroom with his Bible open before him, and he would just begin in the text, and he would break it down into sections, and he would tell everything that he knew, and that was a considerable amount of information about every paragraph. And so we'll try to do some of that same thing tonight. The first four verses give us a summary statement and David's charge to Solomon. David is about to die. He charged Solomon. The word charged is a very important word. It's a powerful word. It implies more than just telling something. It's more than even telling something urgently or insistently. A charge is instruction that is given that has no options attached to it. This is the way that it must be. That is a charge. And David charged Solomon, show yourself a man, keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, his testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses. Interesting that David uses that terminology to refer to the old covenant, and you might almost think that perhaps nobody knew that the old covenant really existed anymore because of the things that had become regular practice that openly defied the commands of God in the law of Moses, such as the multiplying of wives, the multiplying of horses on the part of a king in order to strengthen his army, and on we could go, listing things that David and then Solomon even took to a higher level, things that obviously were forbidden in the law of Moses. And David begins this conversation with Solomon saying, you must keep the commandments of God in the law of Moses. And he ties it to Solomon's hope for success, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn, so that the Lord may carry out his promise which he spoke concerning me. Say, God's promises are conditional. And David calls to mind that promise that God had made back in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Remember when David first approached the idea of building a temple because he felt kind of guilty that he lived in such a fine house and God's dwelling was in a tent? And God told him that he did not want him to build a temple. And in the ensuing conversation, God gave David some information and made some statements that we recognize as messianic, referring to Jesus. Some of them, I believe, David even misunderstood and thought God was talking exclusively about Solomon when he talked about your descendant. It appears that God was speaking in the long term, the long range. But anyway, David acknowledges that God's promise is conditional, and David said, you've got to keep God's will in order to succeed, in order that God will bring forth what he promised to do if your sons are careful of their way to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul. You shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. In other words, your dynasty will continue as long as your descendants obey me. Well, it didn't take long for that train to get derailed. Solomon didn't even really start out very well honoring the commandments of God in the law of Moses, and there were failures all along the way, and there ultimately came a time when there was no king over Israel anymore for several hundred years, from the time of the Babylonian captivity through the restoration all the way through the intertestamental period. There was not a king over Israel. other than foreign rulers, until the birth of the Messiah, who was the spiritual king of God's people. Now in verse 3, David turns his attention to what had been one of the most controversial subjects throughout the entire dimension of his reign. Now you also know what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me. Remember, Joab was David's first cousin. What he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed. He also shed the blood of war in peace. And he put the blood of war on his belt, about his waist, and on his sandals, on his feet. So act according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace. There is something that David didn't mention here that probably, at least in my opinion, would constitute a greater reason than any of the others for why David thought Joab needed to be executed. Because Joab had killed Absalom. And then David turns his attention to the sons of Barzillai. Show kindness to the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table, for they assisted me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. Then there's another one on the list, the bad list, Shimei. Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite of Behurim. Now it was he who cursed me with a violent curse on the day that I went to Mahanaim. But when he came down to me at the Jordan, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Now therefore, do not let him go unpunished, for you are a wise man, and you will know what you ought to do to him, and you will bring his gray hair down to Sheol with blood. It's interesting that David had forgiven Shimei. Now, David says Shimei needs to be punished. I'm glad God doesn't operate that way. Aren't you? David had been forgiven of the murder of Uriah and the sin of adultery with Bathsheba. Nobody decided way on down several years later that David needed to be put to death on some technicality. You'll notice David says, I swore to him saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. In other words, Solomon, you need to take care of him. I couldn't do it because I promised him I wouldn't, but you give him what he deserves. Here's another way that I think the text reminds us of how the man who at one time had been the man after God's own heart shows us that in everything else, just like we, he was human. He was frail, and he was subject to doing the wrong thing at times. Then verses 10 through 12 record David's death. David then slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. Incidentally, Josephus and other writers of antiquity tell us that David was buried with great treasures, and that several in later days, in fact even Herod in approaching New Testament times, raided the tomb of David and brought out those treasures for themselves. You remember in Peter's sermon, Acts chapter 2, when Peter preached to the Jews on Pentecost, he referred to David's tomb and he says, for we have David's tomb with us yet today. In other words, everybody knew where it was. Everybody knew all about it. not so sure of how valid all of that information is, but it has been passed down through history as at least tradition, uninspired history. David reigned over Israel 40 years. 7 years he reigned in Hebron, 33 years he reigned in Jerusalem. Solomon sat on the throne of David his father, and his kingdom was firmly established. Now in verses 13 through 18, we find Adonijah coming back onto the scene. Adonijah, you remember from last chapter, was the son of David from a different wife. The wife's name was Haggith. Adonijah was the one who decided, since he probably was the oldest surviving son of David, it was surely his duty to sit on David's throne. And so he made himself king, essentially. Did like Absalom did, got him a chariot, a bunch of footmen to run beside it as he paraded himself around. Well, Adonijah, after having had his plans foiled by the king himself at the urging of Nathan and Bathsheba, Adonijah has been told by Solomon to go home at the conclusion of chapter 1. Now here in chapter 2, beginning at verse 13, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and she said, "Do you come peacefully?" And he said, "Peacefully." He said, "I have something to say to you." And she said, "Speak." He said, "You know that the kingdom was mine." A little bit presumptuous there, if I may say so. "You know that the kingdom was mine and that all Israel expected me to be king." Well, all Israel, except for most of the tribe of Judah, and probably specifically, you know, the some of the priests and the, most of the army and so forth. So he's, as we often do, reflecting back on something that has happened and speaking of it in summary fashion, where we, for some reason, feel a little bit comfortable to make generalizations that, when they're broken down and looked at in their individual parts, turn out not to be really as true as we kind of represented them to be. He said, "All of Israel expected me to be king. However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord." Well, you know, that's really all that matters, isn't it? And if it was his from the Lord, I don't see that anybody else would have ever had any claim to it. "Now I'm making one request of you. Do not refuse me." And she said to him, "Speak." He said, "Please speak to Solomon the king, for he will not refuse you, that he may give me Abishag the Shunammite as a wife." Now, Abishag the Shunammite was that young maiden that had been brought in to be David's nurse and to keep him warm at night. Though there was nothing sexual in the relationship brought out in the text, as that being the case, Adonijah is asking for her as his wife. It seems to be a very, very foolish thing. In fact, it appears that Adonijah may not have been one who was noted for his clear thinking or for thinking situations all the way through. That seems to be brought out in the words that he just spoke to his aunt Bathsheba. Now he's asking for Abishag. And Bathsheba said, "Very well, I will speak to the king for you." Now you got to understand, and all you have to do is refer back to the case of Absalom to find verification of this. Whenever someone took one of the king's wives or concubines, that was equivalent to trying to take the throne. And so Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him for Adonijah. The king arose to meet her, bowed before her. She said, "I'm making one small request. Do not refuse me." And he said, "Ask, my mother. I will not refuse you." Surely the king would have given that answer to his mother, and surely everybody would have understood, you know, I won't refuse you as long as I can do this and as long as this is reasonable. She said, let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah your brother as a wife. You know, she could have poured a bucket of hot scalding water on Solomon's lap, you know, and had just about the same kind of effect on him. Solomon answered and said to his mother, and why are you asking Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him also the kingdom. For he's my older brother, even for him, for Abiathar the priest, and for Joab the son of Zeruiah. In other words, don't you see this is a ploy to try to get back into this plan to take the throne so that he and Abiathar and Joab will have their neat little kingdom, their reign established, and you and I will be put to death. That's not stated, but it would be implied. Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, may God do so to me and more also if Adonijah has not spoken this word against his own life. Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and set me on the throne of David my father, and who has made me a house as he promised, surely Adonijah shall be put to death today. So King Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he fell upon him so that he died. Incidentally, Benaiah, it works about as hard as anybody does in this chapter. He's mentioned specifically by name 7 times. King Solomon is mentioned in this chapter as the main character 14 times. But Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, really gets a workout before this chapter is over. The next section, verses 26 and 27, deal with Abiathar. Abiathar was the high priest. Do you remember where Abiathar came from? You remember back there in 1 Samuel chapter 22, when Saul, in a fit of rage, had all of the priests of Nob killed. Doeg the Edomite was the only one who would do Saul's bidding to kill all of the priests of Nob. They were all the sons of Ahimelech, the high priest. One of those sons escaped. His name was Abiathar, and he went to David carrying the ephod. And from that time on, he became David's royal priest, and when David became king, he was automatically the high priest of the kingdom. And so Abiathar had been with David from almost the very beginning. But Abiathar, in the end, had turned against David's will and God's will and had joined the ranks of those who supported Adonijah. And so to Abiathar the priest, the king said, go to Anathoth, to your own field, for you deserve to die. Why did he deserve to die? Because he had turned against Solomon. Being the high priest, he surely would have been aware of God's intent that Solomon be the successor to David's throne. You deserve to die, but I will not put you to death at this time because you carried the ark of the Lord God before my father David, and because you were afflicted in everything with which my father was afflicted. And so Solomon dismissed Abiathar from being priest to the Lord in order to fulfill the word of the Lord which he had spoken concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. Now back in 1 Samuel chapter 2, you remember it tells us there about the wickedness of Eli's sons. And the latter portion of 1 Samuel chapter 2 tells about a man of God who came to Eli and spoke to him concerning what was going to happen. For one thing, he said, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are going to die on the same day. And about three or four chapters later, the Bible tells us of the death of Hophni and Phinehas, along with a great host of the army of God's people on the battlefield with the Philistines on that very occasion when they had taken the Ark of the Covenant to the battlefield and lost the battle, and the Philistines wound up capturing the Ark of the Covenant and taking it back to the temple of their God. But it was in that chapter that the man of God came and told Eli several things. One of the things that he told him was, you and your descendants, there will come a time when you will no longer be priest. Eli was a descendant of Aaron's son Ithamar. With the death of Abiathar, who was a descendant of Eli and Ithamar, Aaron's son. With the death of Abiathar here in 1 Kings chapter 2, actually with the demotion of Abiathar, he doesn't die in this chapter, but with his demotion from the priesthood, the fulfillment of that prophecy was complete when the man of God told Eli, there will come a time when none of your descendants will any longer serve as high priest. And so that's the meaning of that last phrase there in verse 27. You might put down a reference of 1 Samuel chapter 22, verses 27 through 36. The next section, verses 28 to 35, tell of the end of Joab. When you compare that information given in that paragraph there, it's actually a sad account. You compare that information to what we know of the life of Joab and the service of Joab as he had served King David. There were times when obviously Joab made some really bad decisions. There were even a couple of times when Joab made a better decision than King David did. But in this section, Joab comes to his end. The news came to Joab, for Joab had followed Adonijah, although he had not followed Absalom. And Joab fled to the tent of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar. Remember, this is the second time in the Old Testament that it tells of somebody fleeing to the tent of the Lord and taking hold of the horns of the altar. It was told King Solomon that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord. Solomon sent Benaiah, go and fall upon him. Benaiah came to the tent, said, the king said for you to come out. He said, no, I'll die here. Benaiah brought the word to the king again, saying, thus spoke Joab, and thus he answered me. The king said, do as he has spoken, and fall upon him and bury him, that you may remove from me and from my father's house the blood which Joab shed without cause. The Lord will return his blood on his own head, because he fell upon two men more righteous and better than he and killed them. Solomon has bought into the story, I see. He's following along in the same logic and the same reasoning in justifying the death of Joab. Remember, all of this is necessary because Israel demanded a king to be like their neighbors. And this is what kings did. And so Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, verse 34, went up and fell upon him and put him to death, and he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. The king appointed Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, over the army in his place, and the king appointed Zadok, the priest, in the place of Abiathar. Well, we've eliminated everybody except for one fellow, and that's old Shimei. And remember, the command that David gave Solomon was, you're a wise man, you will know what you ought to do with him. And so the king sent and called for Shimei, verse 36. And he said, build for yourself a house in Jerusalem and live there, and do not go out from there to any place. For on the day that you go out and cross over the brook Kidron, you will know for certain that you shall surely die. Your blood shall be on your head. Shimei said to the king, "Don't you worry." Sound like a good arrangement to me. That's exactly what I'll do. And in fact, he says, "Thy word is good. As my lord the king has said, so your servant will do." And Shimei lived in Jerusalem many days. But, verse 39 says, it came about at the end of 3 years that two of the servants of Shimei ran away to Achish, the son of Maacah, the king of Gath. And they told Shimei, saying, "Behold, your servants are in Gath." Then Shimei arose and saddled his donkey and went to Gath, to Achish, to look for his servants. And he went and brought his servants from Gath. It was told Solomon that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and had returned. And so the king sent and called for Shimei and said to him, "Did I not make you swear by the Lord and solemnly warn you, saying you will know for certain that on the day that you depart and go anywhere, you will surely die? And you said to me, 'The word which I have heard is good.' Why then have you not kept the oath of the Lord and the command which I have laid on you?" The king also said to Shimei, "You know all the evil which you acknowledge in your heart, which you did to my father David. Therefore the Lord shall return your evil on your own head. But King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever." So the king commanded Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and he went and fell on him so that he died. And then the closing words of that verse, verse 46, will form the end of our study of the life of David. "Thus the kingdom was established in the hands of Solomon." In other words, this is how it all came about. That's basically what that statement means. I can only hope that you've learned as much in this study as I have. I suspect that maybe you didn't, because I was compelled to study a little bit harder than you were in the preparation for it. But I appreciate your interest, and I appreciate the comments many of you have given me throughout the course of this study. It has indeed been a rewarding one for me, and I hope for you as well. If you're subject to our Lord's invitation, we invite you to respond as we stand together and sing this song.